across America. Live, this is Point of View. And now, Pina Dexter.
Thank you very much for joining us, ladies and gentlemen, for Point of View. We have a packed show today, some great guests coming on the program with me. I'm very excited. And I do want to mention that posted at pointofview.net is an article out of the Austin American Statesman. The Austin School Board unanimously approved a new sex education curriculum that for the first time will teach elementary students about sexual orientation, gender identity, and sexually transmitted diseases. The vote, which came in the wee hours of Tuesday morning, had at least one conservative group considering legal action over the source of the learning materials. And, you know, the question is, why did they need this new and revised curriculum? Why did they pass it? For more than a year, says the newspaper, district administrators, parents, community members, and advocacy groups grappled with what to teach elementary and middle school students. Do you really need to teach third graders about these things? Austin's human sexuality and responsibility curriculum has not been changed in a decade for elementary students and in 7 years for middle school students. Under the new curriculum, educators will also teach lessons on healthy relationships, puberty, pregnancy, and reproduction. Parents may opt their children out of some or all of the lessons. Well, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, a lot of these things really don't change. And 10 years ago in Texas, we had battles over sex education, and it was kept abstinence-based in those battles. But now, this curriculum, not only is it pro-LGBT, it's also pro-abortion. And it's controversial, but in Austin, it has been passed. And Jonathan Sines from Texas Values is going to join me for a couple of segments during this hour to talk about it. They have been opposing it, of course. And just what can people do now? Why did this happen? And are other cities in Texas at risk for the push to get this type of curriculum in the schools? How should people look at it? So we're going to talk about that. I'm going to also go through, because I promised last time I was on the program, I promised to talk about the constitutional amendments that early voting is going on right now in Texas. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And then in the next hour, I am very excited to speak with Carrie Severino. She is going to join me on her book. It's Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court. It's been a year, ladies and gentlemen, since that confirmation. Carrie Severino, and she is head of the Judicial Crisis Network, and Molly Hemingway, who's a TV personality, conservative, they got together after Kavanaugh was confirmed to the Supreme Court, and they decided to write this book. I'm going to ask Carrie why she thought it was so important to do so. It's a great book. I actually read it cover to cover and really soaked it in because I was just sort of so emotional when those hearings were going on, as I know were many of you. And Carrie sums it up. She gives us information that we didn't know, and she kind of weaves in a history of the Supreme Court, which is great. And then she talks about what are the trends. Can we expect this kind of attack on conservative and constitutionalist originalist nominees in the future? Yes, I'll answer that right now. We sure can. But the fact that that was pushed back and that he actually ended up on the court is encouraging. So how can we make sure that happens, as we are, you know, fairly certain that President Trump will get the opportunity to nominate one or more Supreme Court justices, not to mention the justices across the court system, many of whom are also embattled. And I'll ask her about that, too. So there's much to talk with her about. She will join me in the second hour today, and that will be fun. But let me just go back a little bit to these constitutional amendments. Right now, it's early voting, which takes place up until November 1st. And then after that, the actual election on these constitutional amendments will take place on November 5th. So you've got some time still to vote. And, you know, sometimes people skip this because they don't understand the amendments, but they're important. Some of them are very important. I would say Amendment 4 is the most important of the whole list. And I talked about it the other day, but let's just mention it again. That amendment would place a ban on enacting a state income tax on individuals. And if someone in the state government were to try and enact an income tax, it would require a constitutional amendment and a two-thirds majority vote to make it happen. Well, you know, we are proud in Texas of our lack of a state income tax, and it's responsible for many companies and individuals coming here, and it's responsible, I think, for a lot of the prosperity of the state of Texas. And so there's one gentleman who's with Texas Public Policy Foundation, and his name is Rod Bordelon. He says, the Texas economy competes globally because of low taxes. He believes voting against Prop 4 will mean the Texas economy will suffer. But the Texas teachers, I'm not saying every teacher, but the organization, organized teachers, say there's more to the proposition that meets the eye, and they're in, against it. This is the Texas State Teachers Association. Because, you know, of course, anytime you raise taxes, it's ostensibly always for education. They say if an income tax is ever collected, the majority would go toward public education. And some of them believe that one day we'll actually need that. Quoting him, quoting this gentleman, his name is Clay Robinson with the Texas State Teachers Association. Not tomorrow, not next year, but at some time in the future, and nobody knows when that's going to be, Texas is going to have more revenue. Since the Constitution says that collected revenue would fund schools, he wants to hold on to that safeguard. They want to hold on to the ability to raise state income taxes. But I think to shore up our lack of a state income tax in Texas is a wise idea. And if you look at one organization that I trust for their positions on these amendments is Texas Eagle Forum. They adamantly oppose the state income tax. They're for Proposition 4 because Proposition 4 would guard against raising state income taxes. So that's an important one. I will give you, after my interview with Jonathan Sines, in the next segment or two, I will come back to this issue and we'll talk about the rest of the amendments. Some of them are more interesting than others, but I'll just give the recommendation of Texas Eagle Forum, and also just the Texas Public Policy Foundation has put out explanations of these, so we'll pick out a few of those and talk about it. In case you are interested, in case you need some guidance, I don't want to tell you how to vote, but I'll give you Texas Eagle Forum's position on it and just some facts that might help you in doing that. And, you know, you can do it, as I said, through the 1st, which is Friday, or you can go and vote on Election Day, which is November 5th. Be one of the ones that makes a difference. You know, your vote is impactful when you're one of the few voting. It makes a big difference, and I think it's part of our stewardship as citizens, and certainly we can affect the future of the state of Texas. So I'm going to vote. I'm going to take this guide with me. I agree with all of Texas Eagle Forum's recommendations, but you may not, so we'll talk about that and so much more. So stay with us for more of Point of View. We've got a very interesting and packed show that I'm looking forward to. I hope you are, too, and I hope you'll stick with me. We'll be back.
This is Viewpoints with Kirby Anderson.
Economist Thomas Sowell filed his last column a little over a week ago. At the age of 86, he certainly has earned his retirement. We'll miss his insight, but benefit from his books and columns he has written over the years. One of his last few columns had the engaging title, Football and Fallacies. As is so often the case, he takes on one of the fallacies of the liberal left. He talks about the reaction from players in the NFL when a black punter took the field. One of the defenders cried, fake. His reaction was understandable since you never see a black kicker in the NFL. So Thomas Sowell put it this way. I've seen hundreds of black players score touchdowns, but not one kick a point afterwards. I've seen a black president of the United States before I've even seen a black kicker in the NFL. The point he is making is that politicians and judges have always assumed that statistical differences between racial groups indicate discrimination. If so, does that mean there is discrimination among kickers in professional football? Of course, we all know the answer to that question. Owners and coaches will pick the best player regardless of their ethnic background. In fact, they'll even take a foreign player who cannot even speak English if they can kick a football. The lesson here is that we have been told for decades that statistical differences are automatically a reason to suspect discrimination, whether between races or sexes. He goes on to remind us that some of the differences, for example, in wages between men and women have more to do with their different career choices. So let's be honest. Some statistical differences do point to discrimination, either overt or subtle, but in most cases, the differences are due to other factors that have nothing to do with discrimination. This is a lesson I hope politicians and judges can learn from this football story. I'm Kirby Anderson, and that's my point of view.
Take Kirby and the Point of View team with you on the go with the Point of View app. Search for Point of View Radio at the Apple or Google Play stores.
You're listening to Point of View, your listener-supported source for truth.
Thank you so much for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. I have on the line with me now Jonathan Sines, Esquire. He's the president of Texas Values. And Jonathan, thank you so much for joining me. I know you've been alerting us all week, actually for more than a week, about Austin ISD adopting a radical sex education program. And a lot of folks, parents, showed up at a school board meeting, but their voices went unheeded because it passed, didn't it?
Yeah, you look, I mean, the room was overwhelmed with parents and concerned citizens from across the Austin area that clearly voiced their concern and their opposition. And many of them did it in different languages. There were several people speaking in Spanish. They felt like some of the Spanish-speaking communities had been really left out of this process. And the reality is that Austin Independent School District is taking risks when it comes to issues of sex. They're taking risks when it comes to something that the community is concerned about. And really, they're taking risk with the sex education as it relates to the law. And those things were pointed out very clearly. But as has been the pattern with Austin ISD lately, they're ignoring what the overwhelming number of people have said to them and going in a different direction. And so, and look, these people are all over the political spectrum, too. I mean, it is Austin, and still a lot of parents, many that consider themselves liberal, think that, you know, this radical sex education has gone too far.
Well, you know, I just remember battles over the years, Jonathan, where we've succeeded, pro-family groups have succeeded in keeping the sex ed curriculum in Texas mostly abstinence-based, for instance. And when you have an LGBT agenda coming in, I mean, there's nothing about it being abstinence-based. As a matter of fact, it assumes sexual activity. And to be teaching this to third graders, or really anyone, but this starts in third grade.
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, you're right that across the state of Texas, we've had success when it comes to our state standards of and our state law of making it clear if you're going to teach sex education, it has to have be abstinence-based or teach abstinence more than anything else. And actually, that was an issue that was raised because there are concerns about how that's been changed in Austin ISD and a real question about whether or not they're following the law when it relates to this. It's important for people to know, first of all, that you don't have to teach sex education in public schools in the state of Texas. There's no requirement. But if you do teach it, there are requirements about how it has to be done. And Austin ISD, I mean, they have a pattern in history, in our opinion, of wanting to focus more on a whole lot of other issues that don't relate to teaching abstinence. And there's a reason why the statutes in our state has prioritized teaching abstinence more than anything else is because we know that it's the only method that works 100% of the time at preventing pregnancy and preventing sexually transmitted diseases. All these other methods and drug-based, prescription-based contraception, condoms, all these different things, none of them can ever be at 100% of preventing those things. And so it's a big difference. And so, but this curriculum goes way beyond even sex. I mean, and biological issues, it goes into really a promotion of a political ideology and putting Christians in a position to where you're going to have students being trained to point out when there are Christian students that continue to have a biblical worldview and really a scientific-based worldview when it comes to issues related to sexuality, and you're going to have all these students being taught by Austin ISD, you know, really to confront these students about their biblical beliefs because somehow that there's something wrong with them believing that.
So this is actually part of the curriculum. I'm seeing a point describing it. The curriculum will shame kids who share a biblical worldview. An entire section of the curriculum focuses on teaching kids to denounce homophobia and how to denounce fellow students who do not agree with same-sex marriage. Talk about indoctrination, Jonathan.
Well, and look, I mean, there's a hearing going on, I think, today about related to school safety. I mean, there's been concerns that we've seen about, you know, having a better environment in our public schools and concerns about threats of violence. And so this does not help the situation and concerns when you've got really a curriculum and pushing an ideology and really encouraging, if not close to demanding that students be in this position now of calling out other fellow students that have a biblical worldview. That's going to create a much more hostile environment. And the other side tries to talk about this of, you know, we're trying to be inclusive and this is about, you know, making sure that we protect all children. Well, apparently not. Apparently all doesn't mean if you're a Christian. And that is the message that's being sent. And that's, you know, this issue is far from over, but we've got a website, noradicalsexed.com, that people can check out. And of course, they can go to our homepage, TX Values, to see more about our work on this issue. But we've had over 7,000 people that have signed a petition, in opposition to this, sex education that passed on Monday night.
Jonathan, one of the areas that, certainly the young generation children are being targeted with is that gender identity issue. And we have been covering the story, of course, of James Younger. And, you know, that's such a sad story. But just the idea that in schools now you're going to have the radical LGBT agenda taught means that it will even be encouraging of young children to question their own genders, do you think? I mean, will it be?
Well, I mean, that's a part of what you see in this curriculum, too. I mean, they're encouraging students to really ask themselves the question about these sexuality issues. And we got to remember, this is in third grade. And, you know, I mean, you're talking about kids that are, I don't know, 9, 10 years old, maybe 8 or 7 years old, depending on where their birthday falls. And so, and one of the parents pointed this out, or someone that testified, you know, what happened to the focus on STEM and on math and science? I mean, this curriculum in Austin is 1,100 pages, 1,100 pages long. And so you can just imagine what the amount of time that they'd have to spend on this. And so, you know, you see this play out in the Jeff Younger case with his son James, that there's a lot of movement, there's a lot of effort, there's a lot of pressure by some people to really force this on children. I think a lot of people are surprised to find out that there's nothing in our law that says that a child can't be forced or be in a position where they will be moved through a chemically based and medically based transition, sex transition, that, you know, there's some stages of that will be irreversible.
Let me ask a question about that before the break here, because, you know, there's now been a lot of publicity to the Younger case, and you've had the governor weigh in, you've had Ken Paxton, Attorney General, even Dan Patrick, Lieutenant Governor, and we had a congressman from Texas, Chip Roy, on last Friday. So there's a lot of attention. But you were calling attention to this during the session. Why didn't our legislators, because really now we have to wait 2 years for any kind of legislation protecting children. Why didn't they take it up? What was their reason?
Yeah, look, we're disappointed as well. And because a lot of times these are timing issues. When you see something that's happening right now, the best time to address it is during that legislative session. And so now you got to wait year, year and a half in order to get some type of relief. And so, look, I think a lot of times elected officials, when issues are new to some extent, they can be a little cautious and maybe too concerned about, you know, what people are going to think about it, you know, pressure from people from the other side.
They would have been heroes.
Yeah, they're, well, look, and I'm not defending them. I'm just telling you that's what our impression is, right? But the reality is they're elected to stand up for people that can't speak for themselves and people that don't have that access to be able to do something. So they have a great responsibility. So we were disappointed as well that some people were, you know, I think just more concerned about the perception or how things would be perceived. And, you know, so they didn't do anything on it. But I know that we brought this to the attention of legislators. We had Jeff Younger at our Faith and Family Day in March. And that's where we highlight these issues, and the opportunity was there, and that opportunity was missed. And so, but we know that moving forward, we still got to find a way to do something about this before it's too late.
Well, I guess better late than never. I'm glad the attention is there now, and that, you know, some of the powerful politicians in Texas are paying attention. I hope they hold their attention on this and see it through. We're really hoping that. Well, I want to get back to this Austin situation, and I'm going to ask Jonathan Sines, ladies and gentlemen, after the break about Planned Parenthood, because it seems, you know, you start blaming Planned Parenthood. Well, by state law, they can't be influential in these curricula, but it seems that the folks in Austin, that school board there that's so liberal, has found other places to get their inspiration for for this curriculum. And so I'm going to ask Jonathan about it. We'll talk about some of the other provisions in it and what can parents do. We'll do all that right after this. Stay with us for more of Point of View.
We live in a digital generation. Point of View is reaching this often overly plugged-in generation with truth. You can keep up with us 24 hours a day using your phone, your tablet, your laptop, or your desktop. Search for the Point of View Radio Talk Show on Facebook, where you can keep up with today's issues, learn about current and upcoming guests by liking us on Facebook. Also, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at Point of View RTS. That stands for Point of View Radio Talk Show. Learn, interact, make a difference with Point of View using new media. And here's one way you can make a big difference. Help us increase our reach by spreading the word among your friends. Share a Facebook post. Tag us in a tweet. With enough joining us to plant seeds, we'll see a tremendous harvest. Come on, it only takes a minute. Search for Point of View Radio Talk Show on Facebook, at Point of View RTS on Twitter, and subscribe to the Point of View Radio Talk Show channel on YouTube. Learn, interact, share. The Point of View Radio Talk Show. Point of View will continue after this.
You are listening to Point of View. The opinions expressed on Point of View do not necessarily reflect the views of the management or staff of this station. And now, here again, is Pina Dexter.
Jonathan Sines is with me. Jonathan is president of Texas Values, which is based in Austin, Texas. And it's a nonprofit group dedicated to preserving and advancing a culture of family values. You know that because he joins us often here on Point of View. But Jonathan, Austin is your town. I mean, you went to University of Texas, as my son did, graduated from there. You know, he tells me he loved Austin, but it is kind of a crazy place. It's a town where you've got all kinds of families and a lot of parents not happy about this curriculum because you can opt out. I mean, that's part of this, but opting out of this whole atmosphere where this agenda is being promoted is impossible because it permeates the whole curriculum, doesn't it?
Oh, that's absolutely right. And look, this has gotten national attention. I mean, Austin ISD has 80,000 students. I mean, it's one of the largest school districts in the state and the country. And so you're talking about a lot of families that are going to be impacted by this. And, you know, it's really striking because at one point during the testimony, someone kind of, you know, rhetorically said, well, what, you know, they're going so far with this LGBT agenda. We're not even just talking about, you know, how a baby is created or, you know, how people's bodies work. I mean, this has moved into full-scale LGBT advocacy. And someone rhetorically said, well, what is the school district going to do next? Start having, you know, drag queens come to the school? And a couple people blurted out, they're already doing that. Austin Independent School District in their Pride Week or the whole month or whatever they celebrated for LGBT advocacy, they had a drag queen come to one of the campuses. As a matter of fact, this drag queen has confessed online that he has a criminal record and has been convicted of prostitution. And so, you know, that's why there, you know, of all places in Austin, you saw this issue blow up. I have never seen this many people at an Austin Independent School District meeting. And I've been to a lot of school board meetings. I've seen some that have been close to this big in other parts of the state, but I've been to that meeting before and it was packed. I mean, there were probably 300 or 400 people outside before we even went in. Not everyone got into the meeting. And you had people from all different political backgrounds, all different faith backgrounds, all different ethnic backgrounds that were there. So that was a clear, to me, representation of what where people are on this issue in the community. But it's, you know, it, to a lot of people, feels like it's a sign of things to come in other parts of the state and the country. And
so
if we
is?
Can...
Like, thinking just about Texas, I know the composition of the school board there is very liberal in Austin. But what about the other cities?
Well, you're absolutely right. And, you know, and look, Austin ISD has a big problem. Their enrollment's been down. They're on the verge of closing several campuses. So that school district has a lot of problems as it is. They make a lot of bad legal decisions, in our opinion. They're very hostile to people of faith. And so, but you know, a lot of people live on some of the edges of Austin that enjoy living there, and they do want to coexist. But the school district has made it impossible with this new curriculum. They're not interested in people coexisting. They only want to push their agenda, and they want to push everybody else out. I mean, we had a parent call us that they had to go online and look at the curriculum themselves because they could not believe that it was so extreme, that it had some of the things in it that we were describing. And so, and you know, you pointed this out about Planned Parenthood. A lot mm-hmm. of the sex education programs are pushed by Planned Parenthood and abortion providers. State law now does not allow that to happen. And so Planned Parenthood originally was the one pushing this curriculum. Austin ISD really had to start over, but now they've cobbled together some pieces that part of it includes from an abortion group in Canada. And so how it is that the school district thinks that they still have, you know, are lawful about what they're doing, is a question that has not been answered. And that's why, you know, look, we're looking at all legal avenues, all legal options, because when the parents are not heard, they're left with no choice but to find one way or another to hold the school district accountable.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. Like, when you had all these parents there at the meeting, and how many got to speak? A lot?
Well, there were 126 people that signed up to testify. The testimony went past midnight, and so if people did register by 3 p.m., they were given an opportunity to speak, and so we're encouraged by that, and that allowed for people to see how robust, how diverse, and how clear the opposition was across the board to this new program and curriculum.
Yes, it sure did, but it didn't matter, really. I mean, that's what's so frustrating is you can go to some of these meetings, and it's a preordained conclusion. So it doesn't matter what.
Yeah, no. Look,
think.
It definitely is a concern, and it can be discouraging. It can leave people with thinking, you know what? What's the point? But I would tell people there's momentum now because of that meeting. We have more parents saying, you know what? I didn't know. Now I do, and now I want to exercise my rights. So we'll be putting information out about people how students can opt out if they want to. You know, because that'll send a strong message to the school district and for people to realize that they can make an impact. This story's gone nationwide. I guarantee you that the Austin Independent School District and even the president acknowledged they've never had this many people at the meeting. So they may have already had their minds made up about passing this, but it doesn't get implemented until next semester, until maybe February or March. So there's still a lot that we can do to get the message across to the school district, to other parts of the state, and maybe get this stopped before it starts getting implemented.
Well, that's great. And that's why I'm always glad you're on. And it's always good to have attorneys on the case, too, and being able to sue the school board or whoever you're going to sue. But I know you're getting your strategy together, and you'll keep us posted on that. I wanted to ask about, because we talked a little bit about Planned Parenthood, but is this curriculum, does it promote abortion?
Oh, I think so. I mean, that's, you know, it obviously, there's a part of the curriculum where there's a link that students can access that relates to abortion-related services. And so, but, you know, I mean, with 1,100 pages, we're still taking a closer look at every bit of this. And I'm, you know, from what we can tell, there are a lot of things in here that raise concerns. And I'm thankful that, you know, we've got some attention now from our state leaders and elected officials. We're going to make sure all this attention gets brought to them. And, you know, if there's violations of the law, if they're encouraging or and somehow coaching kids to avoid talking to parents before making decisions about an abortion, that's going to be real trouble for the school district in Austin.
I think so. You know, I'm disturbed by this going down toward third grade, but also what's going on with the middle school curriculum, because I see one of the points here, just one of the activities. Sixth graders are given 20 cards of different sexual activities and made to discuss if anal, oral, vaginal sex is abstinence. So they get to like try to nuance that. These cards are mentioned but hidden from the parents. Oh, great. I guess I think you've exposed it now.
Yeah, and we have a video on a PowerPoint that we put together that's from this curriculum that is way over the top. You know, and it can be uncomfortable to talk about some of these issues, but, you know, this is not, I mean, this is just what's in it. I mean, they are encouraging. I mean, that's the way we read it, that with the promotion, with the discussion about anal sex and oral sex, this is in elementary school, also in, in middle school, in sixth grade. And, you know, that is not and what parents expect. I mean, you'd think if they were going to be teaching this, the expectation would be, oh, they're going to tell kids about the risk and to tell them not to engage in this. We had a meeting about this, and there was a woman there that testified, and she was a former Planned Parenthood sex education educator, if you will, and is now supports the work that we're doing and others. And she said when they talk to students, the students would say they've never been told simply that you don't have to engage in sex.
No, because it's just so assumed that you're going to.
Yeah, the so many of the kids these days are left only to think that it's a foregone conclusion and that it's only about doing it in a less risky way and somehow trying to keep yourself, quote-unquote, safe. They've never been told you can also choose to not engage in the activity at all. And so, and this is just, I think, a good way for parents to understand, the conversations that children are having these days and how much they can be a help by having this conversation. But it also shows you that if this type of curriculum continues, that's what you're going to see. You're going to see more sexual activity. You're going to see students taking more risk, and you're going to see outcomes that are really not what's good for children. And you're going to see kids become more sexually active at a younger age because of curriculum like this.
And the interesting thing about this is that we had actually, across the nation, you look at studies, there's less sexual activity among teenagers, there's lower teen pregnancy, fewer babies born. Of course, part of that's due to abortion. But actually, I think the emphasis on abstinence over the last couple of decades and the battles that have taken place across the country have borne fruit. And now, in Austin at least, and, you know, certainly, it's going to happen in other big cities, especially. It's doubling down on and actually reversing some of these good trends. It's really sad. Jonathan, I want to thank you so much for the work you do. I mean, if you weren't on the front lines, I don't know what we do. I appreciate it, and thanks for joining me.
Great. And people can check out our information at txvalues.org. We are a nonprofit organization. We'd love to have people invest in our work.
Absolutely. You have to stay with Texas Values and keep up with them. You can do it also click through from pointofview.net. We'll be right back. Stay with us for more.
Now, back to Point of View, your listener-supported source for truth.
In the next hour, you won't want to miss it because I'm going to be joined by Carrie Severino. She's co-written a book with Molly Hemingway about the Kavanaugh trial of a year ago, the Kavanaugh confirmation of a year ago, and just taking us through adding some more information. It's such an interesting book, and she's a great guest. So you won't want to miss that, and we're going to talk to her about just the future of the Supreme Court and what she thinks as a very close observer and someone who gets very active in these battles. So stick with me for that. But I want to go back to the constitutional amendments. Again, you can vote. Early voting is taking place right now. 10 constitutional amendments in Texas to the Texas Constitution. It runs through November 1st, which is Friday, and then Election Day is November 5th. And Prop 1, let me just tell you what Texas Eagle Forum says as far as where they stand on this. They're neutral on Proposition 1. That's a proposition, an amendment permitting a person to hold more than one office as a municipal judge at the same time. And it applies more to smaller towns. And, you know, people aren't that busy with one of the appointments, so they can do both. One suggestion has been, well, don't pay them for both. Just pay them for one and let them do the other as a volunteer, because some people were against paying somebody for two jobs. But Texas Eagle Forum is neutral on that. And second proposition, Prop 2, is about, and let me tell you this, all of these are important just to look at and have a position on. This one provides for the addition of additional general obligation bonds by the Texas Water Development Board, and it's an amount not to exceed $200 million. And Texas Eagle Forum opposes it because we don't need any more bond issues, basically, is what they're saying. And, you know, we've approved many other bond issues, and supporters say it's necessary to continue the furtherance of this development board. But the opposition says, we rank in Texas as the second among the 10 most populous states in terms of local debt per capita, seventh in state debt per capita, and fourth in total state and local debt per capita. So again, I always vote against bond issues. I just do that as a matter of principle. Number three, Prop 3, the constitutional amendment authorizing the legislature to provide for a temporary exemption from ad valorem taxation of a portion of the appraised value of certain property damaged by a disaster. And Texas Eagle Forum says local governments can reappraise properties damaged in disasters. But they don't get to exempt the owners from all or part of their tax burden, and those who support Prop 3 think they should be able to do this. It helps people who are victims of disasters. So Texas Eagle Forum is supporting that one, and let's see what Texas Public Policy Foundation says about it. They say it would alleviate many difficult and duplicitous actions by local governments in relation to damage assessment and reappraisal after a disaster. So it simplifies things, and that's why it's being supported by Texas Eagle Forum. Okay, Prop 4, we've talked about at length. It's the amendment prohibiting the imposition of an individual income tax in Texas. The Texas Constitution already requires the legislature to vote by simple majority to seek voter approval to impose this, but this just makes it harder. It would require a supermajority and obtain voter approval to amend the Constitution to impose an income tax. Texas Eagle Forum supports that that requirement so that we can keep Texas tax-free, at least state tax-free, state income tax-free. And Texas Public Policy Foundation explains the issue very well, and I think if they don't take a position, but if looking at their explanations, their one in support of this is very compelling. Proposition 5. Texas Eagle Forum supports it. It's a constitutional amendment dedicating the revenue received from state and use taxes that are imposed on sporting goods to the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department and the Texas Historical Commission to protect Texas's natural areas, water and water quality and history. So sales taxes on sporting goods will be dedicated to wildlife and nature preservation. Texas Eagle Forum supports that. Proposition 6, Texas Eagle Forum opposes. It's an amendment authorizing the legislature to increase the maximum bond amount for the Cancer Prevention Research Institute of Texas. They don't have a whole lot of, they don't think that this group, CPRIT, has been a good steward of taxpayer dollars, and cancer research is not a core function of government, they say. So they oppose more money for them. Proposition 7, Texas Eagle Forum supports it. It allows increased distributions to the available school fund, and they support it. And let me see what Texas Public Policy says about this one. I really respect, they've done a lot of research on these. This is number 7. The permanent school fund, they explain, is a trust. It uses returns on investment on the state's land and mineral rights to create disbursements to this school fund, which funds different forms of classroom education in Texas. And supporters of Prop 7 say returns on investment from this fund would have allowed a greater disbursement in previous years had there not been a cap. So they're raising the cap now, and there have been some lost opportunities to provide funding that would be addressed in doubling the amount of disbursements to the fund. And certainly that's popular, and these conservative groups both seem to explain it to my satisfaction that should be supported. And then Prop 8, let's see, what is Prop 8 about? It's opposed by Texas Eagle Forum. It provides the creation of Flood Infrastructure Fund to assist in the financing of drainage, flood mitigation, and flood control projects. Texas Eagle Forum says this is a new permanent fund, and state-subsidized debt serves as a disincentive to properly prioritizing spending. In other words, the state should be prioritizing this. We don't need a new fund for it. So they say oppose Prop 8. They say support Prop 9, which authorizes the this one has to do with precious metals held in a metal depository not being taxed. They should not be taxed, says Texas Eagle Forum. Prop 10, amendment to allow the transfer of a law enforcement animal to a qualified caretaker in certain circumstances. Texas Eagle Forum, again, supports it. If it is in the best interest of the animal, the law enforcement animals will be allowed to be transferred to its caretaker upon retirement. They think that's a good idea. So those are the constitutional amendments. I have not got anything posted on it, but you can go to Texas Eagle Forum to their website, and you can they've listed their explanations. You can also go to Texas Public Policy Foundation. I have a great little manual that explains all the amendments if you'd like to get that from them, TPPF. So those are and my encouragement is for you to go and vote for these. Just find out about it. Take your little piece of paper into the voting booth and vote. And as we said before, these constitutional amendment ballots, elections, don't draw that many voters. So if you do vote, you have an outsized impact, and you're doing a good thing for the state of Texas if you have an informed opinion about it. So I just want to encourage that. Well, ladies and gentlemen, next up, I am going to be joined by Carrie Severino, and Brett Kavanaugh is on the court, and we've seen how he's operated during this last session of the United States Supreme Court, and yet the controversy and the attacks on him have not gone away, because very recently there was actually a book out, and New York Times picked up some of the parts of the book and came out on the attack again. Some of that actually backfired. We'll ask Carrie Severino about that. She'll be my guest next on Point of View. Sit back, call a friend, and just listen for the next hour. I think you will get an education about our courts. Stay with us. We'll be back.
When you give to Point of View, does it make a difference? Jeremy Dyes would tell you that it does. He grew up listening to Point of View in the back seat of his mom's car, and it helped to shape his thinking.
I had parents that were able to sit across from me at the dinner table after we listened to Marlon Maddox and Kirby Anderson years ago and think through what the scriptures say about these issues of current significance in our lives. That's only possible because Point of View has come along and ministered into my life and made me who I am today. And here I am today defending religious liberty, partly because Marlon Maddox and Penn Dexter and Kirby Anderson were the ones that were pushing me towards all that. They taught me how to think through these issues. They didn't tell me what to think. They taught me how to think.
Each gift you give will change lives. Not every Point of View listener will become a Jeremy, but if they listen for very long, they will be changed, and that will change how they impact and affect the lives of the people around them. So make that decision to change a life today. Join the Truth Team and boldly stand for truth in a world of lies, distortion, and information manipulation. Go to pointofview.net or call 1-800-347-5151. That's 1-800-347-5151.
Point of View will continue after this.
across America. Live, this is Point of View.
And now, Pina Dexter.
Thank you very much for joining me for Point of View. You know, it's just been a little over a year since the Kavanaugh confirmation, and I know a lot of you kind of lived that. I did. It was an emotional experience and just made a big impact, I think, on the American psyche, and the outcome was a positive development, to say the least, for our country. We're going to talk with Carrie Severino. She's written a book about it. For the whole first hour of the program. And then later in the program, Peter Wehner will join me, and he's written a piece in The Atlantic called The Deepening Crisis in Evangelical Christianity. Support for Trump comes at a high cost for Christian witness. Do you agree or disagree? We'll let you weigh in, and we will weigh in and discuss that with him. But right now, you know, going back and thinking about Brett Kavanaugh as a choice for the Supreme Court, that President Trump's choice for that seat that was vacated by Anthony Kennedy. He was a graduate of Yale College and Law School. He authored more than 300 opinions, all guided by the original meaning of the Constitution. In at least three decisions, the Supreme Court actually had adopted his reasoning because he was on the D.C. Circuit. He was seen back then as one of the safer choices. Amazingly enough, when you think back on it. But he had so much documentation that Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate, actually nudged against him. But he went through, and excuse my French, but he went through hell and back in that confirmation. Those of us concerned about the courts also went through it with him. The book that I am about to discuss with its author, Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court, was really a catharsis for me because this was such a national trauma and a trauma for a lot of us court watchers that I relived some of it as I read the book. But I also got to know Brett Kavanaugh better by reading it, to admire him. And the book details the way this all played out and really shows some of this was actually encouraging to me when I saw the support and how that built. And a lot of history of the courts is in this book. It's really good. The author, one of the authors, is with me now. Her name is Carrie Severino. She's chief counsel, policy director of the Judicial Crisis Network. And you sometimes see her on Fox and other TV networks. She did over 100 TV interviews alone in support of Kavanaugh during the nomination and confirmation process. And she also files briefs in high-profile Supreme Court cases, and she alerts us when certain judicial confirmations are in crisis and leads that organization. She was a law clerk for Clarence Thomas and also Judge David B. Santella, the U.S. Court of Appeals for D.C. Circuit. She graduated from Harvard Law School, also Duke University, and she's got a master's in linguistics from Michigan State University. All so amazing what she does because she's also the mother of six young children. Carrie, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks so much, Kenna.
Well, it's good to have you. I really loved the book. I really did. I enjoyed reading it. It was very helpful to me, especially since this was an upsetting period, I think, as it played out, although there was a good outcome. You and Molly Hemingway, you had... Your book's been successful, and that's great for all of you, but you really had a bigger reason for writing the book, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, we knew this was really one of the most important things that happened to the country as a whole last year. Watching this process, it wasn't just Justice Kavanaugh on trial. It was Justice on Trial, and that's where we got the name of the book, because it was people attacking the very notion of the rule of law, of the presumption of innocence, of having due process before coming to a conclusion about very serious charges. And we knew that it was important that people see what had happened, the whole picture, because it wasn't being completely shown in the media. We knew there was more to the story because both of us knew people who had been involved in the process. But, you know, it's amazing. I thought I knew a whole lot about it going in, you know, having been as involved in it as I was, and I learned so much because we talked to, you know, over 100 different people. We talked to the president, we talked to the vice president, to senators, to Supreme Court justices, to all these people who were intimately involved in the process. And we wanted to get all of that out there so people would know the story, because you know that they're not going to just, you know, pack up and go home and say, all right, well, we couldn't block him. We're already seeing people trying to threaten to impeach Justice Kavanaugh, trying to dredge up new and even more specious charges. So it was so important to have the truth out there.
Carrie, you clerked for Clarence Thomas, and really, when you look at him, the attacks against him have never stopped in all these years. Do you expect to see the same thing with Justice Kavanaugh?
Yeah, you know, that's something that really concerns me, because when he was confirmed, if you look at the polling, the people who actually lived through his process, who watched that, you know, incredibly involved testimony on all sides during the Thomas hearings, 2-1 Americans said, we believe Thomas over Hill. They were confident in his story. But if you look at what's happened in the last almost 30 years, it has been a solid drumbeat of propaganda trying to rewrite this history. And I think a lot of people, and you think especially of like the millennial generation, they weren't there. They didn't watch this. And all they've been told is, here's this woman who was a brave truth teller against a boss who is mistreating her. That couldn't be farther from the truth. But if we don't remind people and fight against that misinformation, it's going to happen to Kavanaugh exactly the same way. And we heard from Christine Blasey Ford's own lawyer why that is. She said, we wanted to put an asterisk next to his name. They wanted to discredit him in future decisions, and specifically, she mentioned, in decisions having to do with abortion, with Roe versus Wade. They wanted his vote discounted. And I think the left has been trying to do that to Justice Thomas for nearly 3 decades as well. Hey, if we can take an incredibly strong, principled, and influential conservative and try to tarnish his reputation, then even if we can't block them for being on the court, they're hoping that they can, you know, maybe intimidate them, maybe make people take them less seriously and diminish their influence.
You know, the idea that the court has to be a powerful tool to advance the left's ideology, it wasn't a new idea. I mean, they did this back with Roe versus Wade, but going after a nominee, and we can talk a little bit about this before the break and then continue afterwards, Carrie, but going after a nominee in this way, especially one that's highly qualified like Kavanaugh, it really started with the Bork hearings, didn't it?
Yeah, and part of that is because choosing these kind of principal nominees also really started with Bork for so long. And we detail this just to give people context in Justice on Trial of how for so long, even the Republican presidents weren't looking at the judicial philosophy of their nominees. They saw them more as kind of political favors they could hand out. And you had consistently even the Republican nominees who were among some of the most liberal members of the court and who were being used by the left to achieve with the courts and with the unelected branch of government what they couldn't get done in the elected branches. So if the American people did not want to go to a certain, you know, level of liberal policy wish list that they wanted, and that wasn't where Congress was willing to write a law to actually do it the constitutional way, they would just go to the courts, and the courts time and again gave it to them. As soon as we had Ronald Reagan standing up and say, nope, we're going to have judges who just follow the law, that's when you saw the intensity ratchet up a lot, and it's gotten hotter and hotter ever since.
It's gotten worse, and we will continue to discuss this with Carrie Severino. Stay with us. We'll be back.
This is Viewpoints with Kirby Anderson.
Economist Thomas Sowell filed his last column a little over a week ago. At the age of 86, he certainly has earned his retirement. We'll miss his insight, but benefit from his books and columns he has written over the years. One of his last few columns had the engaging title, Football and Fallacies. As is so often the case, he takes on one of the fallacies of the liberal left. He talks about the reaction from players in the NFL when a black punter took the field. One of the defenders cried, fake. His reaction was understandable, since you never see a black kicker in the NFL. So Thomas Sowell put it this way: I've seen hundreds of black players score touchdowns, but not one kick a point afterwards. I've seen a black president of the United States before I've even seen a black kicker in the NFL. The point he is making is that politicians and judges have always assumed that statistical differences between racial groups indicate discrimination. If so, does that mean there is discrimination among kickers in professional football? Of course, we all know the answer to that question. Owners and coaches will pick the best player regardless of their ethnic background. In fact, they'll even take a foreign player who cannot even speak English if they can kick a football. The lesson here is that we have been told for decades that statistical differences are automatically a reason to suspect discrimination, whether between races or sexes. He goes on to remind us that some of the differences, for example, in wages between men and women have more to do with their different career choices. So let's be honest. Some statistical differences do point to discrimination, either overt or subtle. But in most cases, the differences are due to other factors that have nothing to do with discrimination. This is a lesson I hope politicians and judges can learn from this football story. I'm Kirby Anderson, and that's my point of view.
Take Kirby and the Point of View team with you on the go with the Point of View app. Search for Point of View Radio at the Apple or Google Play stores.
You're listening to Point of View, your listener-supported source for truth.
Welcome back to Point of View. I'm Penadexter. My guest is Carrie Severino, author of Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation, and the Future of the Supreme Court. She co-authored this with Molly Hemingway. And, folks, I'm going to open the phones for questions only. If you have a question about the Kavanaugh Confirmation for Carrie, the number is 800-351-1212. And, Carrie, we were talking about the Bork debacle, which engendered a verb, borking, which was done to Kavanaugh. Right. But it's interesting that that seat, that the Bork seat, that at least we tried to hopefully get Bork confirmed there, ended up eventually being Kavanaugh's seat with Kennedy in between.
Yeah, that's right. It is fascinating to kind of watch the pattern that they go, because Bork, of course, did not get confirmed, and then Anthony Kennedy was the one who replaced him. It's also interesting because the stakes of this seat is the other thing. It's because you have a president nominating principal nominees, as we talked about before, that the left gets crazy. But it's also because of the stakes of the seat. And when Bork was being nominated, it was to replace a swing vote on the court. And what ended up happening, because they stopped having a solid conservative replace a swing vote, is you had another swing vote in the person of Anthony Kennedy. So that just kind of delayed this crisis of a nomination process to 2018, where then you finally were able to get a solid conservative nominee to replace Anthony Kennedy. And so, so we finally have this seat that is moving from a swing seat into a more principled conservative hands.
Carrie, talk about President Trump and his nominees, because many people thought that the death of Antonin Scalia would actually hurt the Trump campaign. And it kind of didn't seem at first when before he was the nominee that he even knew that much about judges. But it turned out to be quite the opposite, didn't it?
Yeah, it was really surprising, I think, to a lot of people, because you have someone who is not a lawyer himself, and there were definitely lawyers in the race at that point. I mean, Ted Cruz, who's well known as being a lawyer, et cetera, people you would expect to run on the Supreme Court, right? So it was very surprising to people when, of all the people on that stage that Saturday in February when Justice Scalia passed away and you had a debate the same day, of all the people to have a really strong opening statement on the Supreme Court nomination, it was Donald Trump. People are going, oh, wow, this is interesting. And he not only said what most Republican nominees or candidates in history have said, which is, oh, I'll nominate someone who is going to support the Constitution, or maybe I'll nominate someone in the mold of Scalia and Thomas, which are great things, but they don't really, you know, they're just kind of the nice things that one says. You don't know if that really means they understand the significance of the court. They understand how to identify those people. He actually got up there and started to name names. And he said, oh, well, I would nominate someone like a Bill Pryor or a Diane Sykes. And the conservative lawyers out there watching really perked up, because he was just name checking some of the most well-known and leading conservative judges in the country. And so everyone said, oh, my gosh, when he talks about, I'm going to find the best and brightest people to advise me on these things, he certainly was doing it in this case. And his counsel, who was during his campaign, and then White House counsel Don McGahn, was really instrumental in helping bring the president's vision of having those Supreme Court justices be principled, to be courageous on the bench, and finding a list of up to just over two dozen men and women who exemplify all of that. That was huge, especially for someone like Trump, who people didn't know if they could really trust him to follow through on those promises he was making. And that gave a lot of, put a lot of flesh on those bones. And now we've seen so far two Supreme Court justices come off of that list to fulfill that most important campaign promise.
So whose idea was it to come up with the list?
Well, you know, we've talked to a lot of people who were involved in it. It seems like the president really wanted to have something out there, because the idea of a list is something that the Washington kind of conventional wisdom was, you can't do that. They thought, oh, well, if you put a list of names out there, the left is just going to go crazy and they're going to start doing opposition research on people. So for a long time, people had said, no, you don't put a list out there. I think it just took someone like Trump who said, well, give me some names. Let me get some names of the kind of people I will do. And just was approaching it from a different perspective. So it was interesting. We found out that the first time Kavanaugh's name came up was actually that same day that Scalia passed away. He wasn't on the initial list that Trump had. In fact, he wasn't even added to the list until after Trump had already been elected and after Gorsuch had been confirmed. But he was someone that was already on the president's radar and Don McGahn's radar as early as that first day. So he was someone who was well known in Washington circles as this is a judge to watch.
You know, you mentioned in the book that many of the judges on the initial list were not in D.C. They were actually people that were out in the states like Gorsuch. And that was, that's actually a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's the reason even though he was someone that they looked at and they knew would be important, that they didn't want to put him on that list, because they were trying to make a point as well with that list. Not only was it an amazing list of men and women, but they were trying to point out that you don't have to have people just from these same, you know, coastal communities on here. And there actually are really significant judges that are being overlooked throughout the country. And another interesting thing, they didn't just have federal judges. A lot of times people forget that 90% of cases are decided in state courts. There are some really significant issues that go on down there. And state Supreme Courts actually give us a better understanding of what someone's real judicial philosophy is in many cases, because they are the final word on so many issues that you don't have to wonder what would they really do if they were on the Supreme Court. So he had a lot of people who had been on state Supreme Courts. So they were already Supreme Court justices in their own way in terms of their state law. And I think that also gave a lot of people go, oh, wow, they're looking at a really interesting new overlooked talent pool. And it was really eye-opening, and I think caused a lot of people to recognize there were some great young talent that now is available to be tapped into if Donald Trump won, and of course he did.
He did. Day one, he had to nominate someone, and he got Gorsuch confirmed. Mm-hmm. But I want to fast forward to Kavanaugh, Carrie. They were going to oppose anyone that the president chose, any candidate for the court for that seat. They would oppose. They really tried hard. I think the worst thing they could get on him was that he had some credit card debt that got reimbursed by his friends for, you know, sporting tickets. I mean, they couldn't get anything. And those hearings were just a spectacle. Even Ruth Bader Ginsburg was critical of that, wasn't she?
Yeah, she talked about how this is not how hearings looked when she was confirmed. I mean, she had a record that was much more political than anything in that Kavanaugh had done in terms of her work with the ACLU. She had been a very strong advocate for women's issues and arguing these cases. And yet she was confirmed virtually unanimously and certainly wasn't attacked in a personal way, in a way of, you know, it's the early part of the process. They hadn't gone quite to the depths later where they're making these character attacks on him, but they were misconstruing his decisions. They were coming up with these apocalyptic scenarios. You had people, 200 people getting arrested outside the hearings because they were disrupting them, kind of treating it as if this is the end of the republic if this person's confirmed at the Supreme Court. Justice Ginsburg knows, you know, she's served with all these justices. She was good friends with Justice Scalia, who she disagrees with, but was able to work with. And I think she has had a much better perspective of recognizing that you can be collegial and you don't have to demonize and vilify someone just because you disagree with them.
You know, you have to wonder about the Senate Judiciary Committee when you talk about collegiality. I mean, your chapter five, things really get hot. And, you know, you call it all hell breaks loose. And it really did. And the idea of Senator Feinstein, the ranking member, holding a letter that was a weapon against Kavanaugh, releasing it so late that you couldn't even really, well, it really put the White House at a disadvantage. I mean, that was just egregious, to say the least. And but it started this whole process, and the Me Too movement played in, didn't it? We just lost Carrie. We need to get her back, Steve. But, you know, really, folks, if you remember that time, every woman has to be believed. And in a sense, when Christine Blasey Ford went to a congresswoman in California, and then they ended up getting the information about, well, what she said was an attack by Kavanaugh on her in high school. Every woman had to believe her, and you couldn't say anything negative about Christine Blasey Ford. You have to believe the woman. That was kind of the mantra, which I think even up until the confirmation, you really still couldn't. We've seen some things come out since. But I think we've got Carrie back. Carrie, are you back on the... Oh, she's not quite back yet. We're working on getting her back. But... And now we are on a break, so this gives us time to get Carrie back. This is an interesting interview. It's a very interesting book. I recommend, if you want to kind of get some detail and closure on this, read the book, Justice on Trial. We'll be back to discuss it after this.
It wasn't long ago, it seemed, every official decision brought religious liberty and our ability to live as faithful Christians into question. Some of us wondered how long it would be before we were literally forced to choose between obeying God or men. That pressure seems to have subsided just a bit, and now is the time not to take a breath, but to work as hard as we can for the future of our nation. Thanks to you, Point of View is doing just that. And our special thanks to those who have become members of Truth Team 360. In football, 22 guys battle it out on the field while 40 or 60,000 watch in the stands and perhaps hundreds of thousands more watch on television. We need a special few to get out of the seats and into the game. Join today by calling 1-800-347-5151 and ask to join the Truth Team, or visit us online at pointofview.net/team. We really do need you. The nation needs you. 800-347-5151 and pointofview.net/team. Point of View will continue after this.
You are listening to Point of View. The opinions expressed on Point of View do not necessarily reflect the views of the management or staff of this station. And now, here again is Pina Dexter.
My guest is Carrie Severino. She is Chief Counsel and Policy Director of the Judicial Crisis Network. She's also author of this great new book, Justice on Trial. It's about the Kavanaugh confirmation. But Carrie, tell us about the Judicial Crisis Network. We've had you on in that capacity before. Today we're talking about your book, but tell us about your organization.
Yeah, so the Judicial Crisis Network, we were founded because we were seeing some of the problems that were happening with people like Bork or Thomas, or you know, the attacks that were being leveled against Republican nominees and conservative nominees, and wanted to make sure that there was a group out there that was able to put up a strong defense, because the left had hundreds of groups that were dedicated to attacking these nominees, and the administration's not really in a position to be able to defend them the same way sort of an independent group is. So we have been around since 2005 doing exactly that, helping defend principled nominees to the Supreme Court, to the federal courts, at state court level, and also to make sure people are aware when there are nominees that are not as principled being put forward to those positions. And we want to make sure that everyone knows the significance and the importance of the courts as an issue going on in this country today. So that's something that made us kind of the leading group out of hundreds, really, of conservative organizations who knew how important the Supreme Court was in these last confirmation processes that we were able to help lead that coalition.
Yes, you were, and you've been very successful at this, not only in the Supreme Court, but other courts. And talk about the importance in this Kavanaugh confirmation of all these groups, because folks listening will recognize some of the names. And they really did cooperate on this effort, didn't they?
Yeah, and it's amazing because there's so many different conservative organizations that kind of each brings their own strength, whether it's different groups that they're speaking to. You know, it's different topics. What, you know, could be pro-life work or Second Amendment or limited government or economic liberty, et cetera. And also some groups that have a real grassroots talking to the voters kind of thing, some that have more of a media outreach, you know, different specialties. And we saw that there were so many different angles that were important to this coalition to get Kavanaugh across the finish line. One of the things I thought was most interesting was talking to some of the groups, there were several different groups who said this, from Tea Party Patriots, Susan B. Anthony list, to Americans for Prosperity, talking about how they felt like their job working on this Supreme Court confirmation didn't start in 2018, but it really started in 2014, because some of these groups were so far thinking, they knew there was going to be major judicial confirmations on the horizon. They said, if we don't have senators who are willing to confirm principal nominees, it doesn't even matter who the president is, because they could put up the best people and you're not going to have the Senate confirm them. So they were working from 2014 on. Of course, that was the year the Senate went into Republican control. And I think that was a huge game changer, because imagine if we had not had control of the Senate, there wouldn't have been a vacancy there for Justice Gorsuch to fill. You absolutely would have had Justice Scalia's seat and then probably Justice Kennedy's seat following that. We could not have had these kind of principled conservative justices in the court.
You know, I look on the cover of your book and I see, because all of us were watching, of course, Christine Blasey Ford and her testimony, and then Brett Kavanaugh, and some of the things he said, because it was really from the heart. He said, "You may defeat me in the final vote, but you will never get me to quit." And, you know, he really stood there, and if he had quit, or if Trump had quit on him, if McConnell hadn't pushed forward, if these female supporters hadn't gotten out there, if your group and all the conservative groups hadn't done what they did, he probably would not be on the court, would he?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there were so many moments where this confirmation was on a knife's edge. And I think, so, you know, it's amazing how many different people probably made that difference in finally getting it over the finish line. And you know, it really boils down to a lot of different profiles and courage. And we talk about some of them, whether it's his own wife, Ashley, who was an amazing support to him, to their daughters, but also, you know, we talked to so many of her friends who said, gosh, she's going through this and she's supporting us. She's praying for us and helping us get through this process, because Kavanaugh's friends were also really being targeted during this. Some of them had their jobs threatened. I mean, it's really amazing what people were doing to try to silence anyone who was standing up for him. And you had similar attacks being leveled against Senator Susan Collins of Maine, who was one of those swing votes. She's not someone who's policies I always agree on. She's a much more kind of moderate Republican. However, when it comes to judges, she is so impressive to me in how she approached this. She hired extra staff. She wanted to make sure, as a non-lawyer, that she understood all of his cases, and she learned them down to the footnotes so that she could absolutely go toe-to-toe with any lawyer debating his record. And she suffered a lot of hostility. You had people who raised over $1 million saying, I will give this to your opponent if you vote in favor of Kavanaugh. You have people sending threatening notes to her house. One person who claimed they were sending ricin, and they had to send out weapons of mass destruction teams to quarantine her house down to her husband and her pet puppy. It had to be quarantined because they were getting these threats. I mean, the level of opposition has been profound, but also the courage really rose to the occasion as well.
She was impressive, I thought, in this, and she was certainly a hero in the long run when it came down to the vote, wasn't she?
Yeah. I mean, this is where you're saying there's so many people if it were not for them, and I think if it were not for Susan Collins having a very statesmanlike approach to this, saying, I know these are really you know, passionate emotional charges, and she took them very seriously. She didn't just discount them or give the back of the hand, but she gave a great lesson in the importance of due process. And go back and watch her speech on the Senate floor the day she announced her vote, and it's an incredible testament to how important it is to look through the facts, look through the evidence, not jump to conclusions, not simply say, I'm going to go with my, you know, the emotion in the moment and let that push me over. No, she did it really systematically, and that was how she approached the entire process. She didn't listen to people who were just screaming, oh, well, if you confirm him, you know, the country is going to do, go to this and that. And nope, she just said, all right, let me look at the cases, and I'll make my own conclusion as to whether, you know, whether that's really supported. And I think we didn't have someone who was willing to stand up to the mob.
Yeah.
At that moment, we could have gone a different way.
Okay. I was, you know, watching the testimony, the Ford testimony, and of course, Grassley, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, did a lot to accommodate her. And this outside female attorney was the one doing the questioning. That was very emotional. And I was watching this so disappointed in what I saw. I mean, it shows what I know, because, this questioning by this Ms. Mitchell actually revealed some inconsistencies, and this was important. But she was not doing it for me or for the public. She was doing this for the Republican senators, and she actually did do her job well, didn't she?
Yeah, I think a lot of people were hoping for something a little more, you know, punchy, dramatic, a Perry Mason moment where they could say, where the person would say, oh, I admit it, I made this opening up, or something like that. That's not what, you know, she is a real life prosecutor. She actually, in the cases that she's trying, she's generally the one who's bringing the case in a case of sexual assault or harassment. So she's used to working with victims, and she was very committed to doing this in a professional way and following the actually correct forensic procedures, which, by the way, as you alluded to, Senator Feinstein absolutely didn't. And Rachel Mitchell said at the end, you know, realize if you want to get to the truth here, what's going on, and having a public hearing this way, this is not the way to do it. So she did her best under those difficult circumstances where the Democrats were insisting that all the questions get broken up into 5-minute increments. I mean, it was ludicrous how they had to go through this, but she just tried to walk Christine Blasey Ford through the allegations, and she kind of let her tell the whole story. And then she started going back and asking some deeper questions about different aspects of it, whether it was her fear of flying, or whether it was the way the numbers and description of this event and who had been there and how many people had been there had changed, or whether it was how she had no idea how she got home and how she could have even gotten home, given the distance from her house and the fact that, you know, there obviously weren't any Ubers around in 1982. Mm-hmm. So, it turned out to be highlighting some of those issues that really brought out the weakness of the allegations here, because this is coming from someone who is used to interviewing victims on a regular basis, and she had a lot of credibility then because she was so careful and polite and sensitive about it, that when she went to the Republican senators and said, you know, this isn't even just a he said, she said case. This is weaker than that, and this isn't even enough evidence that I would be able to get a search warrant to investigate this. This is an incredibly weak allegation. She got a standing ovation from the GOP senators, and ultimately her conclusions were very convincing to some of the most important voices there, like the Susan Collins, the Jeff Flake, the people who were kind of more on the fence and wanted to make sure that this was being done right.
This book is exciting. Go to pointofview.net. You can get an excerpt out of it that'll whet your appetite. We'll be back.
Now, back to Point of View, your listener-supported source for truth.
If I know the listeners to Point of View, and I think I do know them very well, I think that a lot of you would be very interested in reading this book, Justice on Trial, by Carrie Severino and Molly Hemingway. We discuss judges a lot on this show. Kelly Shackelford joins us many Fridays, as do other folks from First Liberty Institute. So it's a big topic here on Point of View. So I think you'd love this book. There's also a piece out of it, an excerpt, an article entitled, it's out of the Daily Signal, "The Moment Kavanaugh's Foes Overplayed Their Hand. It's pretty exciting. And they really did overplay their hand, Carrie, because others started coming forward with these ridiculous accusations that kind of proved to be silly in many cases, didn't they?
Yeah, and actually, those extra allegations, rather than making the story seem stronger, really highlighted the depth to which this anti-Kavanaugh movement was willing to go, because some of these allegations were so absurd. I mean, the Ramirez claims that came second were at least something one could imagine happening, but they were so weak, where she said she wasn't even sure they'd happen until she basically sat with her lawyer for 6 days being talked into the fact that they happened. And you had a lot of people who were saying she reached out to us beforehand and wasn't even really sure if it was Brett Kavanaugh. I mean, that's outrageous that this is then being brought in public and used to permanently destroy someone's reputation under those circumstances. And then you go on to Julie Swetnick and Michael Avenatti and how you know, the idea that he's going through the Maryland suburbs on a serial gang rape tour, you know, through that whole decade is really outrageous. And her story changed, you know, a million times. I think ultimately those ended up creating a pattern, but it wasn't the kind of pattern that the anti-Kavanaugh people wanted. They wanted to show, oh, this is a guy with a pattern of sexual assault. None of these rose to the level what seemed like he'd actually done them. What it seemed like is here's a clear pattern where people on the left are willing to take anyone who says anything, however improbable, however unsubstantiated, and turn it into a national event and try to take this man down any way they can.
Carrie, everybody was hoping to avoid another FBI investigation, but that turned out to be a godsend too, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we thought, oh, this is going to turn into a disaster, having this much more time for people to look up and come up with maybe more fake allegations. But what really happened is the FBI having time to look at those last witnesses in depth, they actually found out more things that helped Kavanaugh than the other way around, in particular the story of Leland Kaiser. She was the one woman that Christine Blasey Ford said had been at that party. She was a close friend of Ford's and continued to be a friend of hers. She's someone who was very liberal, did not want to see Kavanaugh on the court, but she knew this is not something she had any memory of. After really trying to, you know, think maybe it happened, I can try to come up with some details, like not my friend, couldn't do it. And she also later told the FBI about the people who were pressuring her then to change her story. So common friends of hers and Christine Blasey Ford, who were sometimes even threatening her if she didn't change her story from what she knew to be true, that she just couldn't say one way or the other. She had no memory of this event. And that really, I think, uncovered the underbelly of what was going on in this, in the smear campaign. And we talked to a lot of senators who said, we can't tell you what's in the FBI report, but let me tell you, I had a lot more confidence coming out of reading it even than going in. And I think it was things like Leland Kaiser's testimony that really made that difference.
When Brett Kavanaugh gave his statement and, you know, sort of defending himself, of course, and his honor, he also showed real concern for the process. And this is quoting him, "You sowed the wind," speaking to the senators on the Judiciary Committee. "For decades to come, I fear the whole country will reap the whirlwind." This is why you and Molly Hemingway wrote this book, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this will not be the last confirmation process that we see. And if this is what happened when President Trump replaced a swing vote on the court with a conservative, what happens if he has a liberal justice's seat to replace next time? Can you imagine it getting any more outrageous? It's frightening. I think part of the reason that Kavanaugh was attacked so viciously, certainly they wanted to block him, but I think part of it was that they wanted to send a message to the next nominee. You think those two dozen men and women on Trump's list, any of them is excited about the prospect of going through the kind of gauntlet that Kavanaugh was put through? No, they're hoping they can make these people take their names out of consideration so the best and the brightest aren't willing to step up next time, in the hopes that it lowers the quality of the nominees overall. And I think they're hoping to intimidate the court into maybe modifying their positions, because they don't want to start a firestorm like this. That would be a horrible result, because I think that would really give the bullying and threatening and intimidation tactics a victory.
You know, when they talk about court packing, as you hear from some candidates now for president, That's kind of the same idea, isn't it, to threaten the justices to move left?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's exactly what they're hoping to do, is that you will maybe get a Chief Justice Roberts in particular, because we've unfortunately
kind of already happened to him
reporting that he's already done this. I think he's their main target, saying, hey, the Senator Whitehouse had an amicus brief that more or less was mafiosi in its tone. And it kind of said, well, if you don't vote the way we want to in this Second Amendment case, we might have to restructure the court. And we'd hate for that to happen. They're ready to do it if the court continues to have conservative decisions. And I think that is a horrible thing for the independence of the courts. We're not supposed to have politicians threatening the justices. That's why they have life tenure. And so I hope the Supreme Court will continue to stand firm against that kind of intimidation tactic, because we really don't want to lose the independence of our courts.
So looking ahead, Carrie, I mean, Trump could have one or more openings on the Supreme Court, especially if he's reelected, and especially if it's Ginsburg. That'll be a big shift, won't it? It'll
right.
be vicious.
Or, or Breyer. I mean, there are several potential liberal nominees. One could imagine him eventually replacing. I think that's why we have to be so concerned about knowing our history. That's why Molly and I wrote Justice and Trial. We want people to know what happened, so you recognize this is the same playbook that they've been going back to time and again, and they're going to do it again. So don't be surprised. We need to know how to respond when they do, and we need to hold people accountable. There were a lot of bad actors in this, from the senators breaking the Senate rules and procedures, from people who were submitting allegations, some of whom even acknowledged that the allegations they submitted to the Senate Judiciary Committee were false. None of them have been held accountable, despite the fact that it is a felony, the federal crime that carries up to 5 years of prison time. There needs to be accountability, because otherwise we're going to see exactly this type of outrageous behavior as soon as there's another vacancy. And that's not going to be good for, obviously, the nominee. It's not good for the Supreme Court, and it's absolutely not good for our country.
Carrie, thank you so much for just joining me today, but especially you jumped on this, you and Molly, after Justice Kavanaugh was confirmed. You didn't let any grass grow under your feet, and you went ahead and chronicled it. And it's actually a very compelling read. But not only that, I think it's an important book for the future of the court. So thank you for doing that and for just explaining all of it to us today.
Thanks so much. We're really excited we were able to get it done, and we've been glad to see its success so far.
Yeah, it's been successful. Thank you, Carrie. God bless you and your work. And, tomorrow or Friday when Kelly joins us, we are going to talk a little bit about some of the things Carrie's working on, because there are justices out there, one in particular who's well qualified, but the American Bar Association has now not given him that kind of a rating for really political reasons. Carrie's exposed that. I didn't want to ask her about it because I didn't want to take away from our time on the book. But we will be talking about that on Friday. Ladies and gentlemen, next up, Peter Wehner is going to join me, and he wants to see a little bit more civil conversation in politics, and sort of wondering if evangelicals aren't hurting themselves in some way by their support of President Trump. Agree or disagree? You can call in and talk about it with us. Do that after this.
When you give to Point of View, does it make a difference? Jeremy Dyes would tell you that it does. He grew up listening to Point of View in the backseat of his mom's car, and it helped to shape his thinking.
I had parents that were able to sit across from me at the dinner table after we listened to Marlon Maddox and Kirby Anderson years ago and think through what the scriptures say about these issues of current significance in our lives. That's only possible because Point of View has come along and ministered into my life and made me who I am today. And here I am today defending religious liberty, partly because Marlon Maddox and Penn Dexter and Kirby Anderson were the ones that were pushing me towards all that. They taught me how to think through these issues. They didn't tell me what to think. They taught me how to think.
Each gift you give will change lives. Not every Point of View listener will become a Jeremy. But if they listen for very long, they will be changed. And that will change how they impact and affect the lives of the people around them. So make that decision to change a life today. Join the Truth Team and boldly stand for truth in a world of lies, distortion, and information manipulation. Go to pointofview.net or call 1-800-347-5151. That's 1-800-347-5151.
Point of View will continue after this.
Across America, live, this is Point of View.
And now, Pitta Dexter.
Welcome back to Point of View. You know, President Trump has a lot of support from white evangelical Protestants, as we know, and there are reasons for it. His policies have been overwhelmingly protective of the sanctity of human life. He's actually seen by many as the most pro-life president ever. As we discussed in the last hour, he has appointed two stellar justices to the Supreme Court and stuck by one of them under the worst attacks by the left. Plus, he's filling the federal courts at all levels with originalist judges who will protect life, religious liberty, and our capitalist system. He's also issued executive orders that have reversed some of the Obama-era incursions into religious liberty. And he's repealed scores and scores of regulations. He's brought forward this tax cut that's unleashed a good economy, moved the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. Plus, many Christians stand for the rule of law when it comes to illegal immigration. So they sort of like the stance he's taken there. But, you know, there's a lot of folks that just can't abide a lot of things about President Trump. And as a matter of fact, my next guest has written a piece for The Atlantic, The Deepening Crisis in Evangelical Christianity, Support for Trump Comes at a High Cost for Christian Witness. My guest is Peter Wehner, and he served in the Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush administrations, where he was deputy director of speech writing, and he's author of City of Man, which is a great book that I have read, Religion and Politics in a New Era. He's now vice president and senior fellow for the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He's interviewed in media, and he's a contributing editor for The Atlantic Magazine, opinion writer, contributing opinion writer for The New York Times. So you see him out there. We are so honored to have you with us, Peter Wehner. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks. It's a pleasure being on with you.
Well, it's good to have you, and I just I want to let you explain the article. I know it was published back in July, but I doubt that much has changed with regard to your points. You may have some things to add here, though.
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to explain the article and more generally my position toward Christians and their alliance with Donald Trump. I guess what I would say is I understand the support that evangelical Christians give to Donald Trump and why they're happy with a lot of his policies, some of which you named. I think there's some things that are problematic that he's done as well. I think it's a mixed bag, but I certainly think that if you're a person who is philosophical conservative, evangelical Christian, that his positions and policies are going to be better than Hillary Clinton in 2016 and Elizabeth Warren or Joe Biden in 2020. So I've always understood that, and I don't begrudge people for their view on that. What has always bothered me and increasingly bothers me is that I think a lot of the white evangelical leadership in particular, and many white evangelicals themselves, are unwilling to speak truth to power. That is, that they have gotten so caught up in political tribalism that they seem unable or unwilling to call Donald Trump out when he deserves to be called out because of his ethical and moral transgressions, because of his pathological lying, because of his destruction of norms, because of his dehumanization of other people. And so I think that my view of if you're a conservative Christian is, why not do two things at once? Why not praise him for the court appointments, many of which I agree with? I'm a conservative, lifelong conservative. I served in three Republican administrations, served in the Bush White House for 7 years. So I'm philosophically aligned with a lot of that. But at the same time, call him out when he does things that we know are wrong, and that you know that white evangelicals know full well that if a liberal had done, whether Bill Clinton or Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, they would criticize him. I think that is what is at the core of my concern. I think that's discrediting to the world, because they're looking at a lot of evangelical Christians and they're saying they're hypocritical. They're using a double standard. It turned out that they didn't really believe in a lot of the things that they talked about, like personal integrity and morality and political leaders. That was just a means to an end. It was a convenient 2x4 by which to hit, say, Bill Clinton. But when it comes to Donald Trump, we don't care about it. And last thing I'll say is that if you look at the leadership of much of the white evangelical world, Eric Metaxas, Franklin Graham, Jerry Falwell Jr., Ralph Reed, James Dobson, and folks like that, they are his sword and his shield. They are always praising him to the point of being obsequious. And I really think that that fundamentally undermines the witness of Christ, which matters to me more than politics.
You know, it's funny. You mentioned Eric Metaxas first, and I read a piece by him. I know that he was not a Trump supporter at first. In fact, some of these other people you mentioned weren't either. But they came to it, and, you know, some of them didn't come to it until after he was the nominee. And
right.
Even after he was in the White House and they saw certain actions and things. So it was, in some sense, I think, a practical support that exists. And I do hear people like yourself calling the president out. I mean, I don't think that Donald Trump thinks that his behavior is something that, you know, Christians love. I think that they think that he thinks we tolerate it.
Well, yes and no. Name me a single prominent evangelical leader in the political realm. The names that I gave to you, Franklin Graham, Jerry Falwell Jr., Eric Metaxas, Ralph Reed, James Dobson, and others. They actually don't call him out.
Do we know that for sure? That they don't do it in private?
Well, whether they do it in, number one, I think we can be confident they don't do it in private, because we know from people who work with Donald Trump that when he is challenged in private, he doesn't like it. But for the purposes of the public Christian witness, they should call him out in public. Look, Ralph Reed said publicly at a Faith and Freedom Coalition event earlier this year that there's never been anyone who's defended us and has fought for us and we have loved more than Donald J. Trump. No one. Now, Ralph has not taken him on, neither has Metaxas, neither of these other people. They should. There is a role for Christians to speak truth to power. Now, that doesn't mean that out of all the white evangelicals in America, which after all comprise, you know, roughly 22% of the public, that they're not there. I know a lot of white evangelical Christians, some of whom didn't vote for Trump, some of whom voted for him reluctantly, some of whom are deeply distressed by his conduct. But what I'm talking about is the people who have taken on the mantle of Christianity and the positions of Christian leadership, calling him out when he deserves to be called out. They just seem not to do it. Indeed, it's not just that they've gone sotto voce. Not only that they've gone quiet, it's that they defend him time after time after time. Look at what some of these people
said. Let me jump in, because we're coming up on a break. And I don't want to interrupt a sentence. Peter Wehner is with me, and we're discussing the piece, and I posted it at pointofview.net. The deepening crisis in evangelical Christianity, support for Trump comes at a high cost for Christian witness. What is that cost down the road? We will ask Peter Wehner right after this. Stay with us.
You're listening to Point of View, your listener-supported source for truth.
My guest is Peter Wehner, and I posted his article at pointofview.net, The Deepening Crisis in Evangelical Christianity, Support for Trump Comes at a High Cost for Christian Witness. He's also got a book out published in 2019, The Death of Politics, How to Heal Our Frayed Republic After Trump. So, you know, all of this kind of goes, Peter, to the idea that there will be damage to evangelical Christianity because of Trump. What would that damage be in your thoughts?
Actually, in the last few months, by the number of notes that I've gotten from pastors and also all different regions of the country and people who are part of parachurch organizations, who have talked about, one person, actually I quote this individual, Carl Kopic, in Richland, Washington, was saying we're losing an entire generation. And this is the kind of thing that I'm hearing from a lot of pastors, and it's particularly for younger Christians and sometimes actually reporters who spend time in the particular case I'm thinking of, students at Wheaton College. They're seeing this hypocrisy, this freak show, this clown show going on. And they are thinking, is this what evangelical Christianity is about? Is this what Christianity is about? These people, who are hypocritical in their beliefs. A guy like Robert Jeffress, pastor of one of the largest Baptist churches in the country, can't summon the moral, courage to challenge Trump, but is always defending him. We don't want to be a part of a movement like that. And that is a huge problem. I'm hearing from pastors and others who are saying younger people are either leaving the church or staying away from it. Because as you know, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners know, for a lot of people, their introduction to Christianity isn't through some knowledge of Christ or the Bible. It's through what they see and the public witness and the people that they know. And when you see this playing out on a large scale, and people see this transparent double standard, putting power above principle, and they're thinking, I don't want to be a part. If this is what this group that you're a part of is, I want nothing to do with it.
You know, I think you are right that some millennials, that generation and maybe the one following, see supporting Trump as hypocritical. They do see that. They see Christians supporting it. But, you know, I'm worried about the generation for a lot of other reasons too. Like, they're not in church. They are, even the Christians, they see socialism as preferable to capitalism. They're much more supportive of same-sex marriage, for instance. So there's a lot of issues with the education of the millennial. But, but voting, it's not a spiritual exercise. You can't be a purist when you vote. You'll never get a perfect spiritual being in the White House. So you have to make your decisions based on reality. And I think these people that support him so strongly, they do it because they see that he's kept promises and he's done what he said he'd do. And these things, that they happen to like these things, or many of them.
Yeah. I think you're conflating a couple of things that shouldn't be conflated. Again, it's not that they would vote for them. That's not what's causing the massive damage. What's causing the damage is that people are not speaking truth to power, and they're not able to say two things at the same time, which is, look, I need to vote for him because these judges matter and I'm very pro-life. But at the same time, the fact that he's a pathological liar, that he acts in ways that are immoral and that dehumanizes others, that really bothers me. If they were able to say that, that would go a long way toward being an authentic public
witness. Well, maybe they don't think that.
But that's the point. The fact that you take Donald Trump's behavior and you compare it to the behavior of other people, that they took a moral 2x4. Let me give you one practical example. Donald Trump made illegal hush money payments to a porn star while he was cheating on his third wife while she was home with her newborn son. And they seem not to be at all inclined to say something. I remember I was part of the Bill Clinton debate when he had an affair with Monica Lewinsky. And at that time, I heard time and time again, character matters. And they use morality like a 2x4
sure.
against Bill
Clinton. Yeah, that's true.
I actually supported that. But when it comes to Donald Trump, and I'm not talking about just sexual ethics, where Donald Trump is awful. This is a man who would humiliate his past wives by leaking his affairs to the tabloids, Martha Maples with his first wife.
Peter, let me just ask you, because back during the Clinton years, you know, folks supported impeaching him. And as a matter of fact, they did. And a price was paid politically. So do you think that weighs into the calculation today? And the other part of it is that Donald Trump's, those adulterous or alleged adulterous activities were in the past, not in the Oval Office.
Well, those illegal hush money payments occurred in 2016 during a presidential campaign. So that's not that long ago. And I can promise you that all of these people I mentioned, if the shoe were on the other foot and Obama had made illegal hush money payments in the summer of
nobody's refuting that. That's politics, though.
Well, you can't dismiss it by saying it's politics. It's a matter of integrity. It's a matter of using the same standard. And again, it's with Trump. It's not even the sexual ethics. It's the pathological lie that the man lies morning, noon, and night. This has been established. He peddles conspiracy theories. He dehumanizes people. He's misogynist. His business ethics are awful. I mean, from stem to stern, this is a man who is corrupt. Now, I understand the argument, as I said, and I'll repeat it again. I understand if evangelical Christians say, we feel like we have to vote for him because we feel like his policies are better for the common good and the moral good. That's a legitimate argument. I didn't vote for him because I think the damage that he's going to do is greater, but I get that argument. But what I don't understand and what I've never heard a compelling response to is how they can defend him. How can Robert Jeffress go on television day after day to defend and never hold him accountable? And when the rest of the world, both believers and unbelievers, see that, they see the hypocrisy. That's what's at the core. And the other thing I would say is Trump has done, from an evangelical perspective, some important things. But he's also done some things that are kind of problematic. Syrian refugees are at an all-time low. He wants to slash the Global AIDS and Malaria Initiative, an initiative which George W. Bush promoted and saved roughly 10 million innocent lives. Tell me exactly, if you're pro-life, why would you want to gut a program that has saved millions of lives? What about cozying up to Kim Jong-un, probably the most brutal dictator in the world? And by the way, according to World Watch magazine, the Christian groups, is probably the chief persecutor of Christians in the world. What about removing morality as central to foreign policy? What about celebrating a policy that separates children and families at the borders?
Wow, you're almost taking some of your statements right out of the left critiques. And some of these are issues that Christians can disagree on. The people that are evangelicals disagree on. So to say that those are the Christian position, I don't think is really fair.
I'm not saying it's the only Christian position. I'm saying that there is a Christian ethic, and what I hear from evangelical
Christians... And you're defining it.
So are you. Everybody defines it. You define it as well. You talk about, you say these issues for me, homosexuality and abortion, defining. Other people say the global AIDS... Well, you tell me, do you think as a person of the Christian faith, a program that saved between 10 and 13 million people on the African continent, most of whom are children, do you think a Christian ethic would argue for supporting that program or gutting it? What would you say?
I think you could support it, but I think you have to weigh it with a lot of other programs out there. So just to put one program in front of us and say if we're Christian, we should support it, I don't think is fair.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that Christian. Look, if you read my writings over the years.
I have. I've read a lot of your writings.
And you've read City of Man.
Yes.
I've always been reluctant about saying, you can take the Bible and make a direct connection to particular public policies, because what you can do is you can say there's an ethic that ought to inform our views. But you could say that there is an ethic that would have supported the abolitionist movement versus the pro-slavery movement. I assume that you would think that a proper Christian ethic would say that abolition is opposed to slavery, right?
Yes, especially looking back on it now.
Okay, good. All right. What about segregation? Would you say that the proper Christian perspective was Martin Luther King and that segregation was wrong?
Yes, I would say that also looking back on it.
Okay,
you know what, Peter? We've got so many people calling in. I don't know if you have another few minutes to stick with us so that they can ask you a couple questions.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, great.
Absolutely.
Okay, we're going to take it. It's time for a break. We're going to take one, and then we'll bring you back, Peter. I'm glad you can stick with us. 800-351-1212 is the number. We've got a full bank of phones, and we'll take some calls. We'll be back.
We live in
in a digital generation. Point of View is reaching this often overly plugged-in generation with truth. You can keep up with us 24 hours a day using your phone, your tablet, your laptop, or your desktop. Search for the Point of View Radio Talk Show on Facebook, where you can keep up with today's issues, learn about current and upcoming guests by liking us on Facebook. Also, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at Point of View RTS. That stands for Point of View Radio Talk Show. Learn, interact, make a difference with Point of View using new media. And here's one way you can make a big difference. Help us increase our reach by spreading the word among your friends. Share a Facebook post. Tag us in a tweet. With enough joining us to plant seeds, we'll see a tremendous harvest. Come on, it only takes a minute. Search for Point of View Radio Talk Show on Facebook, at Point of View RTS on Twitter, and subscribe to the Point of View Radio Talk Show channel on YouTube. Learn, interact, share. The Point of View Radio Talk Show.
Point of View will continue after this.
You are listening to Point of View. The opinions expressed on Point of View do not necessarily reflect the views of the management or staff of this station. And now, here again is Pina Dexter.
Two things I want to point you to before we start taking these calls for our guest, Peter Wehner. Thank you, Peter, for sticking with us. One is that I posted a piece along with Peter's article in The Atlantic out of the Wall Street Journal. Trump leans on ultra-GOP for support. It was actually over the weekend, and it talks about how Trump has kind of created a base in among sort of this this group of folks that are working class voters. He's brought them into the Republican Party. He's created this kind of base that represents more middle and lower income Americans. So that might be something just to think about, and also while you're calling in, and also. Our last guest was Carrie Severino. She wrote a book with Molly Hemingway about the Kavanaugh confirmation. And one of the things that happened after, you know, at the very end was all these different accusations started coming up. And one of them was, one or two of them were represented by Michael Avenatti, who also represents Stormy, the porn star that's making accusations against Trump. And this is what really, it started to backfire in the Kavanaugh confirmation because these were so outlandish. Now, Trump paid, you know, we have proof that Trump paid the Stormy Daniels, but we don't ever have proof that it all actually came down or happened. And we do have Michael Avenatti, who's kind of a strange creature, being the one that represented her. So that's, I just wanted to throw that in. But let's take some calls. Let's go to Anthony.
Yeah, just,
Sure.
The reason that Michael Cohen is in prison is not because of Michael Avenatti. It's because of those illegal hush money payments. And you know who individual one in those, this is a court document. You know who individual one is in that, document about the hush money payments? It's Donald Trump. So it's not Michael Avenatti who made up claims about the Stormy Daniels. There's actually evidentiary basis. It's the reason, it's one of the reasons that Michael Cohen went to prison, and we have firm documents that Trump made these hush money payments. So
yeah, I'm not denying that. We know he made it. I mean, everyone knows that. Let's go to Georgia and speak with Anthony.
Hello, how you doing?
Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Anthony, how are you?
What's your question for Peter?
Well, I have a question, but I would like to make a statement first. Mr. Wehner, it's pretty obvious to me, and I think most of Americans would say the same thing listening to you. I question your motive. You're making points about a lot of the small negative things that Trump has done and is doing. But when you seriously compare those small things compared to the positive things that he's doing, the positives outweigh the negative. When you consider what his stance is with abortion and human rights, taxes, you know, his stance on how he loves America. When you compare that to Obama, and all the things that he did, just the opposite of what Trump is doing, how can you put so much focus on his personality rather than focusing on all of the, like I said, all of the positives that he's doing? And that's why I question your motive.
Okay, Peter, your response?
Yeah, sure. You know, as a general matter, I try not to getting into question is of motives is always dangerous because our own motives, we hardly know those, let alone other people. So people can ascribe their motives whatever they want. And the larger point about these being small negatives, I think they're more significant. So, for example, I believe, and I understand people who disagree with me, but I believe that the full-scale, all-out assault that Donald Trump is waging on truth, truth as a concept, is very, very damaging to the civic and political culture and the idea of truth itself. And I just don't think that there's any question, and I could run through, if I would run out of time, of the number of lies that he does. I understand people who think that the lies aren't important. I think that the conspiracy theories that he does, I think that asking a foreign power to intervene in an American election is a problem. So I don't think those are small. But let's grant for the sake of the argument that I'm wrong about that and that the positives that he does, policy outweighs the negatives. As I've said about two or three times, and now I'll say it for a fourth time, I understand that argument. And I understand if you feel like, because of your belief on a series of issues, from the courts to abortion to others, that you believe that you need to vote for him rather than a Democratic alternative, and that's better for the common good. So I get that. That's really not the dispute. What I would say that you need to answer, and what I think a lot of people who view the world like you do, is why aren't you using the same standards with Trump that you would use for Obama or Clinton on the issue of character, morality, integrity, and ethics? That is, if you flip things around, and if Obama or Clinton had done the very same things that Trump had done, I can just about promise you that almost everybody listening to our broadcast and you and others would have considered those things enormous issues. Indeed, we've had that experiment. It was called the 1990s, and the Bill Clinton scandal. And I remember many of the same people today who are sort of OCHE, who are quiet with Trump, were defending him, saying time and time again how important character mattered and how integrity did. So all I'm asking you to do is not to vote.
Didn't get the right anywhere to do that because actually the left made gains in Congress and President Clinton was reelected. So it didn't do any good. So I think the right kind of learned that lesson.
But certainly I'm certain that you wouldn't argue that standing for integrity and morality is a utilitarian issue, and you only do it when it's politically advantageous. That's not your position. The reason that you would stand up and say morality matters, you have to defend truth, you have to stand up for matters of right and wrong, is because it's the right thing to do. And even as a person of the Christian faith, you would want to do it. So it's not a question of whether it's you can't make, then you would say you're a relativist. You'd say, well, we'll stand for truth when it helps us politically, but when it hurts politically, we'll stand for lies.
But I don't think believers are not standing for truth. They're just choosing not to criticize and critique the president because they see that he's taking positions and advancing causes that they believe in. So they don't want to hamstring it, basically.
Well, if that's what they want to do, then they should be upfront about it. And then they should say that, look, we don't really care about integrity and political leadership.
I don't think that's fair to accuse Christians of that just because they support the president's policies.
Let me make the argument since you raised the question. If you believe that if your view is character, integrity, morality, ethical conduct matters, but it only matters if liberals go crosswise of those things, then we're going to raise it. But if it's a conservative, if it's Donald Trump, then we're going to overlook it. We're going to defend him. But that's your position, because your argument would be if we raise it, it's going to weaken him. And if we weaken him, we weaken America. Then just come out and say it. Then say, actually, these issues of truth and morality and integrity were mere instrumentalities. They were means to an end, the end being political power. Then that would save us a lot of energy in the debate. We wouldn't really be having a debate about whether ethics matters. You would simply be saying, it matters if it helps us politically. But if it hurts us politically, then we won't really talk about it. Now, maybe that is the position. I think for a lot of a large number of people, that may well be the position, because that explains why, when it comes to Trump, they not only won't publicly challenge him, they will defend him, even though if the exact same thing or a fraction of the same thing had happened with Hillary Clinton or Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, they would raise those issues. That's all I'm saying. Let's be candid about it then. If you really believe morality, ethics, integrity, right and wrong are mere instrumentalities,
I don't think I just don't think that you can. Most evangelicals do not believe that. But they're also not asking for theologian in chief as president. They want somebody to get some things done, and he has gotten a lot of things done.
I understand, but you were the one that made the argument 5 minutes ago that said the reason that they don't want to say these things is they think it'll, in your words, hamstring him. So you're the one who's making the argument that the kind of standards, the kind of moral arguments they would make.
I'm not sure what anyone's motives are, but I think that's a possible motive for some people.
All right. Is it something that you think would be problematic, or what is your view? Would your view be that we should have essentially the same standard?
And I think we should call, just as we called President Bush out on things that we didn't agree with, we could call President Trump out on things. But overwhelmingly, when you see, you're shocked by a person who keeps campaign promises. You're shocked by the stance on religious liberty, for instance. You're shocked that a president would actually be with us on certain things. You can also say those things.
Well, it's fine to be able to. Number one, the number of campaign promises he's kept is actually not that well compared to other people, but even bracket after the time. Again, it's perfectly fine to say that he stood
for
religious liberty.
You know what, Peter? The segment's ending. I appreciate your sticking with us. And thank you for bringing all of this up. It's food for thought. We'll be right back.
Bye.
Now, back to Point of View, your listener-supported source for truth.
Welcome back to Point of View. It's the final segment, and we got a lot of callers on the line. Peter is gone, but we've got lots of folks wanting to still weigh in, so let's go to Auburn in Missouri. Hi, Auburn. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
What are your thoughts here?
Well, I am a missionary from 28 years, and I'm a Trump supporter. But I have the same questions that he's bringing up. I know that he's done a lot of good for our nation, but how much damage to the kingdom of God? And at what price does it come? And I know he's done a lot of good things, but and then I look at the way he has lived and his. We've never had a first lady that has had the past like this first lady. And I think we're opening up something that really looks bad. I mean,
evangelical. You mean because of their pasts?
Not just because of the past, but it's because of things that even now are taking place and things that we allow to slip by.
Yeah.
Because of the good he does, we let other things that we would have never let before in other generations.
Okay, great. Just give me an example, and then we'll move on to another call.
Well, I think one of the examples is the attacks that he makes on people and the things he says and the way he says them and coming out and being very derogatory towards other people and even ones that have served with him. I think that's
yeah, I will agree. He always has a word about everyone. Auburn, thanks for your call. I appreciate it. I think that's duly noted. It is true. Let's go to John in California. listening in on KYCC.
Yes, hello.
Hello. You're on Point of View.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, I just wanted to thank you for giving me the chance to talk for a moment. Even when you ask a caller or the last guest, we'll call them, for an opinion, they never give specifics. And you just ask the last caller for a specific, and it's like this roundabout, oh, this talking about so, or maybe somebody. But there's never a specific. It's this Saul Alinsky thing that's been going on since Clinton and Obama, where they do these things and they blame it on the person who isn't. And President Trump's done a great job. His past is his past. Every one of us most likely has things in our past that aren't ideal. The president is doing a wonderful job for this country. He's doing it for free. He was already rich before he became president. He's doing it as a great service to all of us Americans. And people attacking him, it's only because they're being brainwashed. There is absolutely nothing. If he wants to respond to people who are attacking him falsely and say they're mean or this person's a low life or whatever, I think he has the right as the president, freedom of speech. It's not perfect, but we all have feelings and we all get frustrated. He surrounds himself with people who are Christians and he tries to get input from Christians. He's looking out for Christians. He's looking out for our religious freedom. He's looking out for our babies. He's looking out for our children and grandchildren. And he's doing a wonderful job for all of us. And people need to deal with what is real and not believe what they're seeing in false media on television and believing lies. He's trying to protect America and make America a wonderful place like it has been in the past and can certainly be in the future.
Well, thank you for all of that. We appreciate your call. There's one thing I would disagree with, and that is I don't really think like a person like Peter Wehner is being brainwashed. I really think he's thought out his position and it's worthy of consideration. That being said, I really do think that sometimes you have to, well, this is what Eric Metaxas says. I don't want to say this, but I don't want to, let me just quote him. You know, he didn't support Trump under, when he was running. When he got the nomination, he still didn't really support him, but he listened and he said, nobody talks like that. Nobody talks to the common man. I posted a piece out of the Wall Street Journal today about, you know, the supporters that are coming toward Trump from the working class. But Metaxas said, I didn't decide I think adultery is okay. But when you're voting for a president, you're all often voting in spite of things. And so I think he kind of nails the way some evangelicals look at this. They're voting. They see what Trump's done. They like it. They weigh it against some of this things that are a bit distasteful. And they say they voted for him in spite of this. So, you know, I think that's kind of a rationale that's put out there. And I wonder if you might want to comment on that.
Sure. We like to blame people for their past. Sometimes it helps us feel better. He loves his wife. He loves his children. And what was in his past, I believe that he has asked Jesus for forgiveness. And therefore, God has buried it, and it's not what he's doing today. What he's doing today is looking out for us and really trying to help each person who loves God and each person who loves this country have a better chance to have a better future. And so I'm not going to blame him for his past. I'm just not going to. I don't believe that's what he's doing today. In fact, I can say that I am certain he is not doing that because that's his past. He loves his wife. He loves his children. And I'm really pleased that with so much of the country against him, he's still working for us.
Yeah, I pray for him every day because he's got slings and arrows every day and so much to deal with as he still moves forward with all of that. So thanks, John. I appreciate that. Thanks. And let me just go to Dennis in South Carolina. Hi, Dennis. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Hi. You had me nervous here. I thought I wasn't going to get on.
Well, thanks for waiting.
Thanks for putting me on. I think this guy, I can't remember his name, who wrote that book.
Peter Wehner.
Is Peter Wehner. I think he's self-righteous. I think he's legalistic. He's pharisaical. He's not being a Christian himself by trying to hold somebody account
Yeah, I hate to do that after I just had him on, you know, to critique his persona. Let's just make the arguments. Because I respect Peter Wehner, but I just kind of disagree. I do disagree with the premise of this article.
He was trying to say that we as Christians are okaying all this stuff. That is not true.
Right.
Everybody I know says, I wish he hadn't said that. He shouldn't be talking that way. But there's something that Peter Wehner did not bring up is we love this guy. We really love this guy for the difference he's made in our lives from the years of crooked politicians or just plain politicians who just sold us out to globalists, sold us out to liberal ideologies, and taking this country where the country did not want to go. It was no longer a government of, by, and for the people. And Trump has brought that back. And we love him. And love covers a multitude of sins. That's what's going on. It's not acceptance. It's not looking the other way. It's appreciating. And I wonder all the time, you know, where are you, President Trump, with God? Because you seem so God in the things that you do and say.
On that note, we have to say goodbye. But, Dennis, thank you for your call and all the other callers, ladies and gentlemen. Hope you have a great night. Thank you, Doug. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Karen. God bless you, and we'll see you tomorrow.
When you give to Point of View, does it make a difference? Jeremy Dyes would tell you that it does. He grew up listening to Point of View in the back seat of his mom's car, and it helped to shape his thinking.
I had parents that were able to sit across from me at the dinner table after we listened to Marlon Maddox and Kirby Anderson years ago and think through what the scriptures say about these issues of current significance in our lives. That's only possible because Point of View has come along and ministered into my life and made me who I am today. And here I am today defending religious liberty, partly because Marlon Maddox and Pennant Dexter and Kirby Anderson were the ones that were pushing me towards all that. They taught me how to think through these issues. They didn't tell me what to think. They taught me how to think.
Each gift you give will change lives. Not every Point of View listener will become a Jeremy. But if they listen for very long, they will be changed. And that will change how they impact and affect the lives of the people around them. So make that decision to change a life today. Join the Truth Team and boldly stand for truth in a world of lies, distortion, and information manipulation. Go to pointofview.net or call 1-800-347-5151. That's 1-800-347-5151.
Point of View is produced by Point of View Ministries.